Hey there, everybody. Welcome to a special episode of the Hugo Is There podcast, where I will be having a discussion with some awesome people about the Hugo-nominated fantasy masterpiece Lady Hawk from 1985. Was Back to the Future the right choice for the winner of the Hugo Award for a dramatic presentation that year? Yeah, okay, probably. But we're going to talk about Lady Hawk instead because it's awesome and I feel like it's underrated. So let me introduce everybody who's going to be appearing here. So I'm going to go left to right on my screen. So J.W. Wartick, hey there.
Hi, yeah, I'm J.W. Wartick. I'm a blogger. I blog at eclectictheist.wordpress.com. And you can find me on Twitter at J.W. Wartick. Basically just a fan of science fiction fantasy. I've been on with Seth a few times and just glad to be here to talk about a film that I discovered just kind of on a fluke.
Nice. And then we have Sarah Elkins. Hey there.
Hey, I'm Sarah. I'm a DevOps engineer, longtime science fiction fan, Sorry, did you want us to talk about our experience with Lady Hawk yet?
No, let's wait on that.
Okay, all right. So, DevOps engineer on Twitter as Configures.
Cool. And then we have my big sister, Erin. Hey there.
Hey, I'm Erin Nock, and I'm Seth's sister. I'm not on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm a childbirth educator from Anchorage, Alaska, originally just moved to Washington. And I saw Lady Hawk in the theater.
Yes. I saw it with Erin because Erin was old enough to take her younger siblings to the theater. So as far as I remember, all four of us saw it. I know that at least the three older of us saw it. And that's what I want to start with, kind of opening statements about your experience with Lady Hawk. And I just want to start talking about how the film, like I went on the Spectology podcast a while back and I had hoped to have Adrian and Matt on this podcast, but they couldn't make it. And we were drafting underrated science fiction and fantasy films, and I picked this one. And the reason is because I feel like when you talk about 80s fantasy films, you hear about Willow, you hear about Excalibur and Dragon Slayer and, you know, Red Sonja and Conan the Barbarian, and nobody talks about Lady Hawk. And, you know, it's a really good movie from a major director, Richard Donner. And I feel like it doesn't get the love that it deserves. Oh, The Dark Crystal, I guess, is another one that you hear about. I discovered this movie seeing it in the theater with my sisters, and then it became, you know, a household favorite. We recorded it off television at some point, and we must have watched it 50 times to the point where last night I finally turned to my wife at some point and said, I didn't remember that line. And it was like three quarters of the way through the movie. Everything else I could have quoted right along with everybody. So J.W., why don't you talk? You're the more recent convert, so why don't you talk about your history?
Sure. Yeah, I think I first watched Lady Hawk in maybe 2014 or so.
Okay.
And the only reason that I watched it or even heard of it was because I was on sort of this list binge of finding lists and just watching movies or reading books off of them. And I want to say it was a tour.com article that was like, you know, the top 10 80s fantasy movies, and Lady Hawk was on there. So I'd been watching sort of all the ones that you listed, and I was like, I've never heard of this Lady Hawk thing. And I had to like track it down through like an interlibrary, you know, loan thing, and it came in the mail, and I was like, what is this? Because the cover on the DVD is, you know, very 80s-esque, and
yes,
didn't strike me as something that I would necessarily pick up off the shelf. So, you know, I went on and watched it, and I was honestly pretty blown away. I'm sure we'll get to this later. The music I was laughing at pretty early on, but especially because it just didn't seem to match the tone of the movie, but it really drew me in with just this like innate sense of epicness, but also like the humor that goes throughout it that I really did not expect based on the premise. Ever since, you know, I've been kind of just, I've mentioned it to people here and there, and I'm not sure how you and I started talking about it, Seth, but I just know that, you know, just running into other fans has always been fun because, again, I'm a fairly recent convert, hadn't heard of it at all, but I've watched it like maybe six times since.
You've probably watched it more in the last, you know, 8 years than I have. I think I've only watched it twice in that time. And I just picked it up on Blu-ray. I think you had posted something about how come there's not a commentary edition, you know, or like a special edition of Lady Hawk.
Yeah, it was actually really hard to track down a Blu-ray. At least I don't know if it still is, but when I bought it on Blu-ray, it wasn't even available like in any form other than like getting it, like I want to say from Europe in like an NTSC format so that you could watch it here. So yeah, it's still, I think it's fair to say it's very obscure.
Yeah. I picked it up recently and it wasn't too hard to find. So I think people ought to be able to find it if they want to. So, all right, Sarah, opening statements from you.
Sure. So I saw it in the theater. I'd seen Matthew Broderick in War Games in the theater in 1983. I had a big crush on him and I was glad to go see him in a medieval fantasy in 1985. Yes. Sure. That's all I knew going in. None of the other actors meant anything to me at the time. I bought the novelizations of each one, War Games and Lady Hawk, and they were both very good novelizations. They added a little bit of characterization without messing anything up. I kept both of them for years, but I think it during some move I unfortunately now looking back let them go, but I did reread the novelization several times too, and then just recently I watched it on YouTube. It was easy to find on YouTube or Google Play. So yeah,
nice. Aaron, why don't you go ahead and go next?
Well, I think I probably saw it in the theater more than once because that was the way that I did back then. But somehow I can't remember. I can remember sitting in the theater and the feeling of watching it the first time and not knowing what was going to happen next, being afraid that a favorite character would die, which is my least favorite thing in a movie to this day. But when you were mentioning War Games, I didn't see War Games, but I had to quick like look up when Ferris Bueller's Day Off came out because I was thinking, did I see Matthew Broderick before this? But I'm not sure that I did. So I'm not sure I knew any of the actors. I feel like I knew Rutger Hauer. He was the one I had a crush on. So so I feel like I must have seen him in something, but I'll have to look up what it was.
Probably Blade Runner.
Maybe. He was so young.
Yeah.
And in this movie, he just looked so young to me.
Yes. I followed him then, you know, for the rest of his career. But yeah, but I remember just loving Matthew Broderick and Michelle Pfeiffer. She was so ethereal, kind of, you know. I preferred her movies where she stayed ethereal, but
yeah,
which she didn't always. So yeah. yeah, no.
Yeah. I mean, JW, you mentioned the, you know, the elephant in the room is the score. Because for some reason the Alan Parsons Project was brought in to do a more electronic soundtrack on there, mixed in with things like strings, but there's big synth in several places. It's very 80s. It dates the movie quite a bit. But, you know, personally, I remember the music was a huge highlight for me seeing it in the theater. I thought it was just exciting and driving. I'd never heard music like that in a movie before. And so I've always loved it, even though I can objectively look at it and go, okay, yeah, yeah, I get it. You know, if you did a Hans Zimmer score with this, would it be better? Yeah. Yeah, probably. There's still a couple places in the movie where the score, even though it's electronic, that I really, really like. There are places where it's an odd tonal shift.
Yeah. I remember the opening credits jarred me because I thought this is a medieval fantasy. But I think the picture of the big hawk flapping in your face jarred me more than the music did. I've talked about this book a little with the author, Jo Graham, and she thinks that the music is okay. Sometimes if they go, it depends on the audience. And if they sort of react to old-timey music as kind of twee, and what they're trying to go for is a direct emotional interaction. To me, at the time when I watched this, that movie was marketed to me. It was made for me. I was a teenager. They were doing rock, you know, like you know, I'd seen I forget if I saw Flash Gordon before or after, but that had a big heavy rock soundtrack instead of a classical, you know, 2001 type thing. So I guess I'm okay with the pounding rock score as the horse runs across the landscape and all of that. It was just the opening title sequence that threw me off the most.
Okay.
Nice. And my kids laugh and laugh and laugh at the music, but they love the movie.
Yeah.
But the first time we watched it together, their laughter as the movie began, I was like, what is wrong with you? This is like, you know, like this is heart pumping. This is getting you ready for the movie. And they're just laughing. I'm like, I don't get it.
Yeah. So we watched it last night. And when the opening credits come up, I remembered that there was like, you know, lettering going across the screen and stuff.
Big eye.
And when it started, it was with the kind of slower, more gradual build in the music. And I thought, okay, I thought I remembered the, you know, the rock stuff happening here. And I thought, no, it's just some synth and stuff. That's okay. And then, yeah, it started. And I went, okay, yep, this is what I remembered.
Well, yeah. And I think for me too, the music, it kind of grew on me. Even like the first time I watched the movie, like initially, like I said, I was laughing at the opening credits for sure. Yeah. But you know, there's almost something just unique about, you know, having this very epic, I mean, the cinematography is gorgeous, right? And here's this, you know, guy on a horse with like the sun rising in front of him, catching a hawk on his arm. It's like, and you're like, okay, that's actually, you're like, you don't see that. You don't hear that in any other movie that I'm aware of. And it almost sets it apart. So like I handed this movie to some friends of mine actually, and was like, hey, you're going to love this movie. I know you will. Be prepared for the music. Don't prejudge it based on the music, but like, you know, and they said the same thing that kind of like it put them off at first, but then it was just like going along with some of the, like the one-liners that were unexpected and stuff. It all kind of comes together in like this complete picture. And if you're anything like okay with 80s culture in any way, it's actually to me more endearing than it is off-putting.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. I mean, it's definitely of its time and it does date the movie, but as long as that's okay with you, you know, it still works. And there are, I'll mention as we go through the plot of the movie a little bit, there's a few key areas where the score is phenomenal. So how about we just kind of dive into going through like in set pieces in the movie. One thing I noticed was the movie really moves. It does not take any time at all to get the main characters together. And I had kind of forgotten that. I thought there was a little longer time where Philippe was on his own.
So that feels a little different to me, because to me, the escape sequence took some time, and there's all the time where Philippe is bargaining with God. Right. So he has a lot of dialogue all on his own, him and God, which I think was a great narrative technique. But you see him running along, running, you know, with his hands under his armpits and, you know, trying not to freeze to death after
having not much further, just 250 more miles.
Yes. So to me, It actually took longer than I had remembered for them to get together. So I guess it's just, you know, and I really liked the his bargaining and dialoguing with God. I hadn't thought about it when I first saw it, but when we rewatched it recently, it's a great narrative technique.
Yeah,
because it's getting you to understand more about what's going on than just when it's then maybe, you know, a lot of the audience might not know much about the medieval world, or, you know, and you know, it his faith is real to him. God is real. He's really trying to bargain. So all of that initially, before we run into more characters, To me, that really helped kind of set the feeling, you know, and you do get the idea that he's traveling across a lot of territory for a teenager on foot, you know, or a young man on foot. He seemed my age when I watched it. as a teenager. So you get the idea that this person running across the landscape trying to escape is covering a lot of territory. He's not dawdling.
But you also go ahead. Sorry.
I think the other thing about that scene is that it appears to pass so fast because he's running away. And so it's like a driven scene. And so I can agree with both of you. I love the bargaining with God and the and his self-talk and the funny way he's running, you know, because you would if you weren't using your arms. I think it's very well done. But it appears to me it passes really fast because you're with him. Like we're getting away. We're getting away.
Right. Yeah. And it's kind of sprinkled in. You start meeting different characters. You see the bishop, you see Marquet. At some point you finally see Navarre, but he's just in the background, right? He's just watching. And I really like the way
bells and he knows something's going on.
Yes. Yeah.
Is this my moment?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So the first set piece in the movie is the escape with Philippe. And it's kind of juxtaposed with him in the sewers and then showing some of the mass that's going on, you know, where he's trying to break into the cathedral and gets his hand stepped on by Marquet. What a jerk. and then the bargaining with God. I've always wondered when he is below the cathedral and that ox head comes floating towards him and he freaks out. I've always wondered, what did he think that was? Did he think it was a monster of some kind? I have no idea.
I definitely took it as like an alligator or crocodile because I don't know if it was the quality of the DVD or something, but there's a marked contrast of what it looks like on Blu-ray versus what it looks like on DVD in that scene. Mm. And on DVD, it was more grainy and stuff, which I don't know if that would have been the original, how it would look.
Right.
But I definitely thought, oh, there's actually an alligator in that water because that's what it looked like to me. Yeah.
That's what I thought monster. You know, I didn't pin it down to alligators, which unfortunately you usually don't see coming. They're usually coming at you underwater. But
are alligators even native to Europe?
Probably not.
I don't think so.
But anyway, I just thought monster coming at him, and then it's just an old skull.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I like that where he, you know, he's praying, you know. If my prayers, you know, is held true, then this ledge will remain steady as a rock, and that thing coming to me, towards me, won't be what I think it is. If it is, no hard feelings, of course, but I'd be very disappointed. I didn't write down the exact line.
But. My favorite line is before that, when he's getting out of the sewer. It's not unlike escaping mother's womb.
Yes.
But I am a childbirth educator and even back then was interested in that kind of thing.
There we go. Yeah.
Yeah. I wrote down several favorite quotes, but I think we'll get into them later. So
Yeah. And then I like right after he realizes it's just a skull coming towards him. And then you hear the chant from up above and it's just a wonderful moment where he looks, I believe it, Lord. You know, he's going to climb toward that voice. And then,
exactly.
I'm a wonderful person. And then, you know, he falls back down, ends up in the lagoon, and commits his first act of thievery again. Yes. And I love the, you know I promised, Lord, never again, but I also know that you know what a weak-willed person I am.
So watching it this time, I thought, well, he could have rules lawyered it and say he promised God never to pickpocket again. Cut purse is different from pickpocket. So I was like, you could have, well, I guess this is just a kid who's not thinking in terms of rules lawyering. You know, he made a promise in the spirit of not stealing, and he's recognizing that he broke that promise already. But that thought did cross my mind that you could rule lawyer your way out of that, or you could try.
And I was going to say, when I was watching it the second time I noticed this, and then more recently when I just rewatched it last night, the sort of juxtaposition between the faith of Mouse and the faith of the bishop.
Yes.
Is so strong throughout the movie. And I'm not sure thematically if that's like necessarily where they want you to go with the movie. I don't know exactly like what they're trying to do with it, but it's definitely there in such a strong way. I mean, Mouse has this sort of like very concrete you know, promise equals consequence equals deliverance, you know, and yeah. The bishop is so obviously cynical. And I think they actually refer to his powers as like satanic at one point.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe more than one point. And so it's like that juxtaposition, though, sort of like being a person of faith, it just like really struck a chord with me. Yeah. And also putting that into such a humorous context where there are multiple jokes in this movie that, you know, I almost thought if you didn't know at least sort of some bare bones basics about like Catholicism, for example, there's a Lent joke later, you know, right. That like you wouldn't necessarily get. And it just sets the theme and the tone of the movie so well in this first scene, because I kind of went in expecting pure epic fantasy, ultra serious. And, you know, the first scene that we see is not that at all. It's quite yeah. very funny. Laugh out loud funny.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, the belief in God in this, it's certainly, there's more to it in this movie than in a lot of movies. Yeah. There's a part where the bishop says, you know, something like part of my job is
and believing in miracles. Faith in,
yeah. Right. I believe in miracles. And he does. And yet he's so obsessed with Isabeau that he's made this bargain with Satan or something. Yeah. One of the things, this all seemed super foreign to me when I watched it as a teenager. My mom was a big British Anglophile. I didn't have much experience with French history. And so it all seemed so foreign. And I kind of wondered later if, you know, I really do think, yeah, you know, somewhat at least marketed towards teens, if it was kind of set like, why is this in France? Right. Well, you know, it's a very Catholic movie, so you wouldn't, you know, you could have had it in very early in England, you know, before Henry VIII and so on, but mm-hmm. But maybe they just wanted the whole thing to be more foreign to the American audience. Mm-hmm. And maybe it let them play with things like a bishop having a pact with the devil. How can that be? You know, that sort of thing. Yeah. But one of the things I really like there, Mouse is very engaging. He's very funny. He's had a super tough life. You can tell, you know, doesn't know really even who his mother was, right. Much less his father. He's had a really tough life, but he has humor and he's a believer in God. Mm-hmm. And that I think is that's not something you see in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not a big heroic figure, you know, and he's not honest, but he believes, and he believes that he can have a relationship with God, even though he's a weak-willed person. So right. there's a lot of value, I think, to that. And yes, contrasted with the bishop all the way, who's, yeah. you know, a bishop in a church, you know, so yeah.
Yeah. The thing that I think is interesting is that you start with him with that kind of sort of simple faith that he has, just dialoguing with God, right? But he's selfish. He's thinking of himself. And so through the, you know, looking at it from a Christian practice kind of idea, right? How is his faith working itself out in the real world? And in the movie, he has a great arc where he comes to realize, hey, here's this thing that I could have an impact on. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, ultimately he becomes less selfish and helps mm-hmm. These two star-crossed lovers to reunite. And I think that's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's actually more faith than that in the movie too. There's more than just those two characters, because there's Imperius.
Yeah. And we'll get to him.
Yeah. But he has another story of faith, faithfulness. Yes. And then you have Rutger Hauer and Michelle Pfeiffer and their mm-hmm. faithful love and their faith too, that someday things will work out. You know, it is a very interesting movie from a faith perspective.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Before we move on from the introduction of the bishop, my sister Trish found out, played by John Woods, that's Professor Falcon.
Yeah.
From
War Games.
War Games. Yep. So, you know, so the two major characters in War Games, Falcon doesn't get a lot of screen time, but he's very important to the yes. movie plot. And, you know, kind of similar here, although mm-hmm. he's much more of an antagonist in this Lady Hawk. So,
yeah. Yeah. You know, once Philippe has escaped, essentially, and the Marquet comes in and you meet the bishop, right, when he says one of the prisoners just escaped. And I love that, you know, no one ever escapes from the dungeons of Aquila, Marquet. And then you know, you get that line where it would be a miracle if he managed to make it through the sewer system. I believe in miracles, Marque. And I love John Wood's delivery. It's very flat, very, you know, low sinister. Pitch. Yes, sinister and staccato, and it's just tremendous.
Mm-hmm. He's a good contrast. Villain.
Yeah. A good contrast with the tone of the rest of that early part of the movie, too. It, you know, if there wasn't that seriousness and that sort of, like you said, the flatness to it, it would almost devolve into silliness very quickly. And it doesn't, because he is so sinister and consistent throughout the film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So kind of moving out of the initial escape, it kind of goes into the part where Philippe is not very good at lying low. just brazenly stealing from people and then running into, you know, an inn and loudly proclaiming that he wants the most expensive wine. And I love that bit where he's like, you know, then you drink to me, little man, you know, I've seen those dungeons. And he's like, oh, a stone cutter, you know, but a prisoner from inside Aquila. I didn't say I was a prisoner. And I've always just loved that the way Marque just reveals his helmet. And then there's a fun, I mean, one of the things that I remember most as a kid was, you know, I was 11 maybe when I saw this. And so Philippe's just a few years older than me, and watching him wriggle out of the grasp of the soldiers and go under the platform and up top onto the arbor and all that kind of stuff. I just found that extremely exciting.
Mm-hmm. Trish, my sister said that's why his nickname is Mouse.
Right.
Because of the way he wriggles in and out of things, which is like real mice. Mm-hmm. As long as they can get skulls through, they're kind of like octopi. They really can move through a lot of spaces you wouldn't expect a body that size to be able to. And that's like Mouse. He's, you know, wriggling through things, you know, in the escape through the when he's trying to escape after he's bragged in the village and the soldiers are there, you know, running under the house, wriggling under the house, wriggling through the chicken coop or whatever it is, you know, he's an escape artist. So,
yeah. And of course at that, they're about to execute Philippe, and this is where Navarre makes his first entrance. And it's really interesting the way all the soldiers respect him. Even Marque isn't quick to be like, let's start a fight with this dude. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the one idiot who still fires a crossbow bolt at him and catches one in return. And there's that moment of recognition between Navarre, former captain of the guard, which you don't even know yet, but you kind of get a little implication of it between him and Francesco, this guy who still loves him clearly.
There's so much rich character building going on in this movie. The joy in one soldier's face when he says, Captain Navarre, he's so happy to see his former captain is alive and well.
Yeah.
And of course, Marque doesn't like that at all. Right. he's the captain now. But there's a lot of stuff going on where you realize there's a whole rich story behind all of this.
Yeah.
Because for a captain to get his men to not just recognize him, but be glad to see him alive again, you know, something went on in the past for that to happen. And there are moments like that in multiple places in this movie. It's much more rich on the rewatch than I had realized watching it back then.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, you know, the menace of Navarre, where he's used both his crossbow bolts, right? That weapon isn't going to do him any good anymore. And they're still not trying to take him down. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what Marque's plan exactly was. And of course, he murders Francesco on Navarre's sword. And that's very sad. And I've always loved the haymaker that Navarre throws at him, which clearly was effective. And then you start, you know, you get the music going again and the fight between him and the other soldiers. I love when he just walks up to one of them and just slaps the sword out of his hand.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. He doesn't have a weapon, but he's not having it.
I was going to mention that too, just in that whole scene, you know, with like the swords going up through the bottom of the trellises and all that. You know, again, it's like it's sort of this mishmash of humor and seriousness. And I don't know if you could tell this, you know, before, but you can tell the swords are very blunt, you know, which to me was a big contrast from a fairly contemporary movie, Princess Bride, which is another one of my huge favorites. But where they use like, very sharp swords in a lot of the scenes. But that scene, like you just said, where he slapped the sword. I mean, rewatching it last night, I was like, man, I can't believe I didn't remember that, because it's just such a good, again, piece of character where it's just like, you know, you assume he's wearing a gauntlet or some sort of heavy enough glove that it doesn't matter, but just to have the audacity to be like, no, I'm done with
get
you.
Get that out of here.
And it just makes him into such a good, strong, you know, character right away. I just love it.
Yeah,
his presence in the movie is so large, and that scene gives him his place in the movie to be this big main character.
Mm-hmm. So then, the next scene is they move into the woods. Go ahead, Sarah. Sorry.
Speaking of characters, I don't want us to overlook Goliath, Captain Navarre's big, beautiful black horse.
Yes.
Oh, I loved that horse. And through Aaron the too. Movie, you see it's super well trained. So it's got that classic Arabian, the horse breed is Frisian, and apparently this movie sparked off a little frenzy in Frisian buying. But anyway, played by Othello. In the cast, that's the horse's real name was Othello, and but the way you see it comparison and do these war figures and the high trotting, that was an extremely well trained horse, and to me that just added to it. I mean, and those war moves are useful in real wars. There are reasons horses were trained to do those kind of fancy looking moves. It wasn't just for show. It was strategic stuff going on. But man, I loved that horse.
Oh yeah, so, yes. I know my sister
came in loving Matthew Broderick, came out loving Matthew Broderick and the Frisian horse. horse,
and it was the package for me: the Rutger Hauer and the horse.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Well, they're clearly old friends, right?
Yeah, I think they did such a good job choosing that horse, because I'm sure that they thought of a lot of different breeds. You've got a lot of big horse breeds, but just that horse had such weight, you know, the big furry forelocks and the, you know, I mean, just, you had to use a massive horse.
Yeah. I thought I remembered reading that the horse was painted to be even more black, but I didn't look it up. So.
Yeah. I don't know, but it looked gorgeous. I hope it wasn't hurt during the filming.
Yeah.
And the choice too of it being a black horse, you know, I think another major theme of this movie is subversion of tropes. And you have the black horse for the good guy and the white horse for the bad guy. It's so stark.
And the bishop obvious, all in white.
It's so well done. And that horse is just gorgeous. I'm not even like a horse person, and I thought it was a gorgeous horse.
It's an exciting scene when he jumps over the gate and then Navarre bops the guy on the head.
And then he scoops up Mouse.
Mouse, who has not stayed around to watch the fight. Mouse is on his way.
He knows when it's good to get out.
So the next scene you have kind of, and it's not Navarre's first lines, but it's his first lines to Philippe, other than "you out." That's all he said to him in the previous scene. And his first line to him is, "Stop your chattering. We'll spend the night here." and they stay with the poor couple in the woods, which of course that all goes badly, but you get your first little bit of the unveiling mystery where Navarre opens up his saddlebag and takes out a gown and you can see him looking at the setting sun and he says, "One day." I just love the fact of how gradually that's all revealed. You can just see the longing on his face. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
So there again, the couple in the woods. I was shocked when suddenly the farmer was coming at Matthew Broderick with an axe. And I'm like, what's happening? I don't understand. Well, now I've read a lot of fantasy and also know more about the world. And know that, you know, it's a common plot element where this nice couple in the woods, they take in travelers and kill them and take their money and so on. Right. And I just wasn't even aware that was a thing, either in fiction or in real life. And, there's also stories by Saki, Hector Hugh Monroe, where that kind of thing is going on in more modern days. And I just wasn't aware of it. It's there in the movie. It's never explained. You get it or you don't. For me, it was just more of kind of the chaos of the movie. And now rewatching it, I'm like, there was so much going on in this movie that it was a very immersive movie. You know, yes, there was also Mouse is talking with God, you know, exposition, but there was a lot that was just going on filmed and shown and not referred to verbally. Navarre and Mouse don't discuss afterward what happened there. I didn't understand why they attacked us. No, it just moved on. Too much to cover in this movie. We're moving on.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I love the little bits of humor, like we've talked about throughout, where he's, Philippe is walking around gathering sticks and just griping about everything. And it's like, well, whatever it is, I'm not going to do it. You know, he wants something from me. And so he's just like, I'm out. And then a stick cracks and he's in that situation where I've been in where I'm alone and I heard a creepy sound and now I'm going to pretend to be brave. You know, oh, good, Pierre. You brought your crossbow.
Yes, he makes up his whole band of supporters and walks with them.
And I love
does different voices.
Yes, and then he goes. Just finally, he's like, "I'm out," and he goes bolting through there. And show no mercy, Pierre. We're not interested in prisoners. I love that. And then you know, it always just scared the crap out of me when the farmer comes around the back of that tree, and there's that good music hit with that kind of scream sound. And then we get the wolf for the first time, even though I think we've heard it howl before. And this is where we get the wolf for the first time. And then 11-year-old Seth's absolute dream weaver, Michelle Pfeiffer, showing up as Isabeau. And I mean, I was just smitten in deep smit from the very beginning. Indelible memory for me.
Yes.
And the lighting on the scene is good because then when Philippe is describing her later, saying she was like fine porcelain. Well, of course, she's wearing a black robe in the moonlight, you know?
She was so smooth skinned. I mean, she was beauty personified.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The cinematography in this movie, there's a lot going on in it. And, the lights and angles and peaks and all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did want to mention that too. The cinematography just throughout, I think is, if you don't even like the movie, you could watch it just for the beauty of the landscapes. And it's not just showing, like anybody can just show a mountain, right? But it's the way the angles set up, the way the light is set up. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of those scenes are from the first time I watched it, just burned into my memory as like when he is grabbing the hawk, with the sunset just there. And so like the silhouettes and, and here, like you said, another great example where she does look like fine porcelain because of the moonlight and the black robe. Mm-hmm. It's like every single piece was just thought out in the exacting way to make the best of the lighting, the angle. And you don't see that all the time, right? There's plenty of great cinematography out there, but it's like this whole movie has that set up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, a gorgeous location shooting as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, just fantastic. Mm-hmm. The next morning you don't hear them, like Sarah, you said, they don't talk about the events of last night. Although Philippe is talking about it, right? The wolf would have killed me, but tore out the farmer's.
It's hard to have a conversation with Navarre.
It is. Yeah.
Navarre isn't a big talker.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is where you get his first, I mean, I guess you did have a little bit of a monologue with him. He's like, sleep with one eye open and don't disturb me. I'm liable to take your head off before I know it's you. It's the next. In that one that I was just talking about, that's where you find out that Goliath is a boy. Philippe is like, stubborn little lady. Oh, his name. Yes, sorry. and the delightful, Goliath, before we get to know each other better, I feel I should tell you a story about a teeny little man named David.
Yes.
So the next day he mentions Isabeau, right? And this perks Navarre up. Right?
Yes.
She spoke. What did she say? What was her name? Did she have a name? And I love that.
Tell me every detail.
Yeah. And I love that, she might wander into my dreams. And wouldn't it be nice if I could call her by name and pretend we'd met before?
That was a sweet moment.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. And then definitely.
I've waited a long time for such a lady.
Right? Mm-hmm. That's right. Right. So all you knew about this guy first, Navarre, was some captain, violent, big horse, big sword, you know, mm-hmm. crossbow, etc. And now you're seeing there's a softer side to him.
Right.
You know, first time watching the movie, you don't know that, oh, he already knows Isabeau.
Well, and I thought too, if I'm not wrong here, it seems like every time either Isabeau or Navarre, you know, asks him to relate what the other one said, he makes it so floral, you know, he adds yes. so much to the dialogue mm-hmm. and, you know, it kind of gave me vibes of like, I'm not sure if I'm going to say it right, but Cyrano de Bergerac, you know, that yes. kind of story of, except he's not the one who's trying to get with either one of them. He's actually mm-hmm. just, he does want them to sort of love each other more or fully or something. And it just, I really appreciated that he could kind of tell each one of them needed more than the other person had said. And so he just helps them say to each other yeah. what they need to say basically every time.
Yes. He's a romantic mm-hmm. and when he does talk with them, it seems each time he does this embellishment, mm-hmm. he's trying to kind of cheer them up mm-hmm. because yeah. they've both been living very lonely lives. Yeah. Isabeau and Navarre have yeah. just wandering out in the woods and, you know, mm-hmm. and the way he tells these stories, I mean, partly Mouse, Philippe Gaston, is just a talker.
Yes.
And he's not going to say doorway when he can say something more grand than that, you know. Yes. But also, he's trying to cheer them up. Mm-hmm. There's a scene where Isabeau is just so down, and he's trying to help her have a little heart, yeah. you know, a little hope.
Yeah.
I felt like he was filling in the gaps.
Yes.
You know, he's saying what they're not saying, but what he can see in their body language and their in their vocal, you know, tone and things. So he's right. putting words to all of that.
Kind yeah. of translating.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. And you go from the juxtaposition of this nice thought of, you know, I've waited a long time for this lady, to the bishop finding out that Navarre has returned, where Marquet, you know, takes the express ponies, you know, all the way into the capital, interrupts the bishop while he's creeping on a dancing lady. And says, Navarre has, go ahead.
So two things there. Again, the attention to detail in this movie and the backgrounding of information, I just love it. Yeah. So yes, the express horse system, you know, now I understand that countries with good communication systems would set up horse relay stations where horses were waiting yeah. for the courier to come running, you know, riding fast and drop one horse and get on a fresh horse. You know, none of that was explained. You just saw Marquette riding and get off one horse. And there was a weird little thing where he splashed through a pond for like 20 feet and then got out, and there was the horse station. And I was like, you could have gone around the sheep flock instead of whatever. Okay, fine. right. But that whole express system never explained. Either you knew that was a thing, or yeah. you was just like, okay, here's this little horse sequence. And then, Seth, you just mentioned that weird scene where, right, for those who haven't watched the movie, there's a sequence where Marquette is coming to report to the bishop. The bishop is in his courtyard. A woman in a dress with winged, like feather decorated long sleeves is just kind of airplane dancing around. And then she swoops in and he feeds her lips with like a hand feeding thing. And this is clearly something that happens every day. This right. is like his weird bishop fetish thing.
Yeah.
You know, the bishop has a big nose. He looks kind of like a hawk. You know, this magic with Isabeau's character, you know, what happened that she's a hawk and Navarre is a wolf? Well, he clearly has this big affinity with hawks. He has this hawk lady dancer in his courtyard, maybe every day at noon. Who knows? Yeah. You know, and none of that is explained. It's just like, okay, I'm here to make my report. So the bird dancer goes away. And it's like, wow, this movie, yeah. There's so much.
Yeah. Yeah. And the reaction of the bishop when Marquet says Navarre has returned, you know, and then just everything drops, walk with me, you know, and they go, you know, talk to each other. And it's very effective. Just talking about the bishop imagines that he had a dream from the Almighty in his sleep, right? Mm-hmm. Satan's messenger is among us and his name is Etienne of Navarre. I think I'm not sure that's what the interpretation should be of your dream that you definitely didn't have.
Right.
unless you want to take the technical definition of Satan, which is the enemy, right? The opposition.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And yes, he is opposition.
I don't think he's actually told everyone, all his you know, servants and the captain, by the way, I have a deal with Satan.
Right.
You know, I'm on that side. I don't think he's told them that. So
no, probably not.
So he's portraying it as, you know, Navarre is Satan, which is, you know, either projection or just savvy, you know, he's not just my enemy. He's evil. So you have to fight him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, you know, he mentions the hawk. Right. He mentions and he speaks of the hawk and he says the hawk is not to be harmed. You see, the day she dies, a new captain of the guard will preside at your execution. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the hawk is very important to him for some reason. And and there is an odd synchrony with the dancing lady, too.
Mm-hmm.
So then we're back over to Philippe and Navarre and you get the great line from him. This sword has never known defeat until now. Because he's chopping wood with it. And you get the history. You get the history of the sword, right? The jewels.
Yes.
And I love the way Philip says, oh, you don't think that I stole this? like, no, this is mine to place. And that's where you get the, you know, I have a quest. What's the quest? I must kill a man. Tell me, does this walking corpse have a name?
and then he decides they should part ways when he says it's the bishop. Okay, you can do that on your own. I'll go
exactly.
this way.
Yeah. And you've given me my life. The truth is I can never repay you. But no, I'm out.
yeah.
He said, I need you to guide me to the safety. Not for the life of my mother, even if I knew who she was. like those little sprinkles of humor are just great. And then, of course, you know, he walks away and the sword goes into the tree and he's like, all right, yeah, I'll gather some wood for the fire.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I've always loved that. Mm-hmm. So it's very serious, but also very funny at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that really made it palatable, too, when I was young and watching it. If it had been too serious, I really wasn't into that kind of movie. And it would have been terrifying, I think, in the theater, because it was so big and so loud and dark, the first bits of it. If you hadn't had that little sprinkled humor, I might have thought, what have I done? You know, brought my little sister and brother to this.
Yeah.
Right. In contrast, in the same year, Rutger Hauer was in a movie called Flesh and Blood, which is another medieval movie with soldiers and swords. It is extremely grim. It's good. But boy, you know, that would not have been a movie for a teenager to see. There's mercenaries betrayed by the one who was supposed to pay them, and then they take revenge. It's dark. It's really good. And Rutger Hauer, you know, a guy with a sword in both movies, you know, quite different in the two movies. So I do recommend that movie, but it was kind of a headbend to realize, oh, those came out the same year. This a light toned movie. Yes. There is danger and deals with the devil and some very scary scenes in it, but it's also light and fun and heartwarming. Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah. Speaking of danger, we move into the next scene where, the next scene is Philippe sweet talks Isabeau into cutting him free. And then he runs off and of course gets captured immediately. And then we have our next action set piece where Navarre rescues him again. And there you have some of the good war moves with the horse, you know, where he rears up at first, as soon as he realizes, you know, Philippe kind of helps him realize that there's an ambush set up. And I love the bit where Navarre hits the guy with his crossbow. So brutal. I love it. Go ahead, yeah. Sarah.
So in the scene where where Isabeau cuts Mouse free, just before then she was chasing a rabbit.
Yes.
You see her running through the woods. She's taken on some of Mouse's clothes because that's more practical for trying to chase a hare in the woods than the gown that Navarre keeps saving for her. Mm-hmm. She's hungry. She's really sad when Mouse speaks up from the tree and distracts her and the rabbit gets away. And, you know, they've been living rough in the woods. Now, she's perhaps a little bit more clean than someone really would have been. But maybe it's all part of the magic. Yes. It's fine. It's magic.
For that matter, Philippe is cleaner than you would think.
For that matter, yes. If from someone who escaped from the sewers, you know, on top of everything else. She's hungry. And I kind of got that feeling. She wanted that rabbit. She would have eaten it right then and there because they've been living rough in the country. And you know, her stuff with the clothes, her short hair, her very practical short hair. I bet she took Navarre's sword and cut her hair off the minute she realized, I don't have time to wash my hair in the stream every night. You know, this is not, you know.
You find that it's been, I think, 2 years that they've been under that curse. And so I think the novelization talked about at some point she cut her hair and left it for him.
I forgot that.
It was like she was giving up.
I should not have let that book go. I should have been able. Yeah.
I haven't read it for decades. But
But I don't remember her cutting off her hair and giving it to him. I just figured from watching the movie again, she must have said, you know, I don't have 2 hours every day to wash my hair.
Exactly. Or any available water to do that if I want.
Right. And it's cold at night, and how she's supposed to dry it without freezing to death.
Yeah. They end up in the fight, and this is where the hawk is wounded. It is not a very good practical hawk thing. It's only on for a split second. It's not a very good thing, but
that the arrow is sitting beside the wing. you're very aware. Yeah.
Right. No, I'm talking about the hawk in flight when it shows struck. It's obviously it's fake, but
someone tossed it and it was never alive. Yes.
It's probably on a wire. It's permissible at the time. You know, there's not a lot in this movie where there's obvious special effects. And so that's fine. There's a little green screen or blue screen, I guess, at the time. But they're both wounded, right? There's an interesting synchronization of him getting hit in the shoulder and her getting hit in the shoulder. Mm-hmm. And this is where you get...
Well, and doesn't the bishop also feel something in his shoulder? Mm-hmm. I think there's really
During the extraction scene.
Right. But there's definitely some kind of sympathetic magic link between them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's tied up with them in some way. And this is where... Navarre puts Philippe on his horse and says, follow this road, you'll find a monk named Empiris. He'll know what to do. Mm-hmm. And I love the... I know this... If you fail, I will follow you the length of my days and I will find you. but even with that stern thing, then when he slaps Goliath on the backside to get him going, and you can see him soften as he says it, because he knows what Philippe is doing for him. Mm-hmm. And so then you meet Empiris, and Empiris is so wonderful.
Walk on the left side.
Yes. We still say that.
So do we. Every time you go across a bridge, someone has to say it.
Yeah. And like in his initial introduction, like you mentioned, JW, there's the Lent thing, which I did not get when I was a kid. And now, you know, where he says, I brought a hawk to you. It's wounded. Oh, good shot.
Yes.
Bring it in. We'll dine together.
No, we
can't eat this bird. Oh, God, is it Lent again already? he does a wonderful drunken bellow.
Mm-hmm. The actor, I'm not sure if I knew this at the time, but I've certainly seen him since then in Rumple of the Bailey.
Yes.
That's a British series. He plays this gruff British barrister. Mm-hmm. My parents, I know that I watched many episodes of Rumple of the Bailey in my teens, but it may have been after the movie. I don't know if I remembered it at the same time. But anyway, this actor is so much fun in this role. It was just an extra bit of fun on the rewatch to say, hey, that's Rumpel of the Bailey, you know, this cast. Huh. And then later on, we'll talk about later. Okay. All right. Yeah, yeah. The traps this Father Imperius has laid in his castle for self-defense. Like, why? You know, you're living in these ruins. Was this just your way of kind of entertaining yourself? If someone ever attacks me, why was he ever expecting to be attacked in his ruins and all of that? But yeah, great character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so this is where you finally get the reveal of the transformation, right? Because you have the arrow there to tell you, you know, like Philippe says, right? The hawk was struck, but you know that, don't you?
Right.
Yes. And you get that, are you flesh or are you spirit? I'm sorrow. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And great then line. Then Philippe is giving Imperius more wine, continue, you know,
right.
Finish the story.
Yeah. That it starts with, he hears the wolf cry and says, it's him, right? Somehow it's him. Mm-hmm. And he said, here, drink, forget. No. An hour ago, you were drunk and you remembered.
Right.
So, and it's a wonderful monologue from Leo McKern about the whole curse. And and when he stops, because he gets to the point where he has to say they were betrayed.
Yeah.
It chokes me up.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Knowing on the rewatch, I don't know, JW, you saw it for the first time more recently. Did you kind of get what was coming there?
Yeah, I think I assumed that it was going to be him. Actually, now that I think about it, the first time I watched it, no. The second, this most recent time, which, like I said, it was probably fifth or sixth. you know, obviously, yes. But I remember the first time, because I'm the kind of person, when I watch a movie, I intentionally try not to guess what's happening, because I just want it to reveal to me what it wants to reveal. Mm-hmm. And so, because I think it's Mouse later then says, you know, like, oh, you know, you were that.
Yeah. Does she know that you were the one who betrayed them?
Yeah.
That's a right. good that's... mental discipline. I guess I'm always trying to figure out what's going on when I watch things.
I am too.
Maybe I should do more receiving and then think about it later.
Yeah. I do that with books too. I just like to let it wash over me some. And I was going to say, with this whole sequence too, it was so humor. It's kind of the same thing as the movie writ large, right? It's so humorous at the beginning. They front load that humor, so that way when, like, honestly, like, pretty terrible things have happened and this tragedy hits, you're almost like mentally like able to like get through it because you've had that humor. You already like the character, and so you're like, okay, yes, he betrayed them, but he didn't mean to, and like you know, he's trying to actively help them clearly. So I just think it's another just fantastic scene that sort of is a microcosm of the movie at large.
Yeah. And I skipped over the extraction scene, and that was one of the places that I mentioned earlier where the score is just tremendous. It's creepy. You have the bishop rolling over on his bed. I love the simplicity of Navarre just kneeling next to his sword and just saying, please. And that whole scene with him getting ready to extract the arrow.
And his sword is in the ground like a cross.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, and their hands over the, you know, as he starts to extract it, her hand on top of his hand on top of hers. It's it's all, each scene has weight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's lovely weight. And then when Philippe is talking to Imperius and getting the story out of him, I think because it's such a tragic story, his like getting him another, can I fill your cup again? You know, that little spark of humor in there keeps you from just feeling like, oh no, you know, you can keep going with him. Okay. Let's learn this story.
Well, and Mouse is a little overwhelmed by all this. This is way over his, he knows he's way over his head. You know, he closes the door on her after he asks, you know, are you a spirit? And she says, I'm sorrow. And he's overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. And he kind of, on the one hand, sort of doesn't want to know. And on the other hand, he does want to know what's going on. And that humor is his way of dealing with this situation that he's in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. He believes in God, but I think he was unaware of the spiritual world.
Yeah. And this is where you get one of the scenes of him embellishing a little bit on what Navarre said, right? You must save this hawk. She is my last and best reason for living, you know.
Yes.
Kind of.
But again, it was what he meant.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Navarre just wouldn't ever speak that way.
It wasn't untrue, even if it wasn't accurate.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So we get the next morning, that's when we find out, Navarre comes and says, you know, there were times I wanted to kill you myself. Did I skip over something you wanted to talk
about? Yes. The bishop has been twisting in pain in his bed. And that's the first time we see Cesar,
right?
Right.
Alfred Molina.
Right.
Dr. Octopus. Yeah. Yes. What a menacing, you know, I mean, the bishop is coldly menacing.
Yes.
Cesar is crazy menacing. He's like, you know, this guy will kill just for fun, will torture just for fun. He's, you know, the bishop is setting a bomb that he can't control.
Yeah. The bishop is playing with evil. Cesar is evil.
Yeah.
Yeah. It also reminds me of Moses, the story of Moses, where the Pharaoh kills all the 2-year-old boys, all the boys under two, you know, and it's that that whole thing. Bishop has just said, kill all the wolves.
Right.
So I guess I kind of thought that Cesar was a wolf killer. That was his job.
Yes.
But you're thinking maybe he was just a killer and the target of this week is every wolf. I don't know.
Yeah.
At the very least, I think he's a trapper.
Mm-hmm. At the very
That's
least.
That's true.
Yeah.
He has equipment for trapping wolves. So,
He just doesn't come across as a trapper who's just trapping and then he's, you know, using the skins to make something and then selling those things at market.
He likes
comes
his work.
Across as a guy.
Yeah, he
enjoys
likes his work
killing.
Too much.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And has definitely been engaged by the bishop to purposely kill black wolves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And we get a subsequent scene that goes over that a little more.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But first we have Imperius introducing the breaking of the curse, right? The day without a night and the night without a day.
Mm-hmm.
And Navarre doesn't believe him. And this is where you get the moment of the kind of hero's journey for Philippe where he accepts the call, right? He's like, well, I happen to be going that way myself. And he uses the term Lady Hawk. So we get our roll credits moment in there.
Well, and I think that the scene, you know, where Navarre doesn't believe him, you know, shows the depth of character again because he has flaws, right? Like he isn't this, you know, perfect epic warrior, you know, who does no wrong. Like, no, he should be taking the advice and going along with that, you know, like Mouse has just, you know, saved Isabeau and so has Imperius. And so it's like, you know, there's no like allowance for redemption in Navarre's mind for anybody else. And he's just so, you know, sort of high strung on it. And ultimately, of course, they all sort of end up saving each other multiple times throughout the movie. And so there's not, I think that's almost another thing that makes the movie really good is that no one is like the damsel in distress. No one is the, you know, prince who needs to be helped out from the castle, whatever it has to be, because they all ultimately need help. They all need to have some of their character's flaws overcome.
Yeah.
You know, I guess maybe with the exception of Isabeau, who doesn't, I guess I'm trying to think of any flaw. She's flawless. So, but you know, they do all have needs though. They do all have to be saved. They do all have weaknesses. And I think that just makes the movie that much stronger. Because we know that he's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So Navarre is starting to give in to despair at this point. He is on a negative arc through most of this movie. You know, a little bit of warmth and humanity between him and Philippe, but things are getting dark for him. And after Isabeau is wounded, he's even darker. He's cruel to Imperius when Imperius is telling him about his vision. Yeah.
Go back to your drink.
And Imperius is so, God has forgiven me, which is perhaps a little self-aggrandizing of Imperius. But anyway, sure. Imperius is finding a way to not be in despair. And not being in despair is important for faith. Mm-hmm. Navarre says to him of God, he has not forgiven you. He has driven you mad.
Yeah.
And Imperius's face, when he hears that, that was a super cruel thing for Navarre to say. Yeah. It may be what he believed, but that's really messing with a person.
Mm-hmm. It's a fear. You know, someone spoke a fear.
Yeah.
But then I do like that Philippe is sort of the go-between between these two fighting brothers, you know, like, well, you know, I'll be the intermediary and then, hey, I'm going with Navarre. So follow us, you know. Mm-hmm. I did skip over, actually. I didn't mean to. If there's a damsel in distress moment, it's hanging off the tower, right?
Yes.
I can deal with it in the fact that she was wounded. And so maybe would not have been able to climb Philippe's arm. And it's not like he's a super strong man either. And so the fact that he drops her is not surprising. She probably weighs more than he does. Mm-hmm. But it's a wonderful moment too of the, you know, the sun comes up and she flies away. And then Jahan comes up there and says, where is he? She flew away.
She flew away. Yeah. I actually was thinking that you were talking about Philippe being the damsel in distress as he's sitting there on the tower.
Yeah. I mean,
yes, she flew away.
Yeah.
I told the truth that she flew away.
Yeah. One thing I did want to talk about, and I had written this in all caps, or like up at the top of my document, normalize people not putting on fake British accents for medieval fantasy, not set in England. Matthew Broderick occasionally affects a little bit of an accent, but it's pretty subtle and it comes and goes. It's the Kevin Costner school of accents. But, you know, Rutger Hauer isn't English. He isn't American, right? He was Dutch, I think. You know, he just speaks with the way he speaks in English, and Michelle Pfeiffer speaks the way she speaks in English. And then everybody else has their own accents. There are some of the guards that sound like they're from somewhere else in Europe. And it's fine. Oh, I have a complaining dog. I don't need fake British accents from my Keanu Reeves in a medieval movie. You know, I would rather them just be American and do the performance, not the accent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because you don't even really notice the accents.
No, except for
if they were fake, you would have.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's why it sticks out when Philippe says, and her eyes glowed. No, she glowed. I'm like, that sounds more Philadelphia than English to me, but that's okay. So this is where we finally do meet Cesar, but it's after another discussion between the bishop and Cesar, right? Saying it's a black wolf. There's a woman. The woman is not to be harmed. Mm-hmm. Or maybe that was in the earlier scene, I guess, when we first meet Cesar. But this is where you have the confrontation with them, where Philippe and Isabeau run into his pelt-laden pack horse.
Bloody pelt laden.
Yes. Yeah. And she loses her mind.
Freaks out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I like the, you know, little man being with big words, you know, if you lay one hand on her, you'll find it on the ground next to your head. Yes. He's like, easy little man, you're frightening me. Yeah. And then of course Isabeau pursues him. And I think this is a good subversion of the damsel thing. Like, she's going after this guy. This guy is clearly a threat. And she's the one who ends up finishing him off, and it's pretty grim.
Yes.
And it's another effective use of the rain and the storm and the score. Really, really wonderful.
Yes. And those traps, those, all the spikes, you know, the scene where, I'm sorry, JW, go ahead.
No, go, keep going.
Those scary, scary traps. And then the way that, Cesar dies in a trap, and it's really grisly,
But poetic.
Yes,
but an uncomfortable moment. Yes. You know, watching
but awful.
That.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It's not quick.
No, you're glad when it's
right. It's not quick. Mm-mm. Yeah. Which it wasn't. It isn't for animals that are caught in traps.
Right.
It's not a quick death most of the time.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. Also the fact that she stood there and basically stood over him, watching him to make sure that the deed was done. I mean, that's what really struck me this go round is, again, I can't help but contrasting this movie with Princess Bride because that's a mm-hmm. longtime favorite. But in the Princess mm-hmm. Bride, there's a scene where, you know, she's just like hitting one of the rats with like a stick, and it's like the most ineffective counterattack ever. Here, Isabeau is just like standing there, like, well, let's make sure this guy's dead, and you know, she's like ready to like make it happen if it needs to, but she's like, I don't need to do anything, but I'm going to make sure it happens. And that, again, like you already said, is very subversive of the tropes of basically any sort of fantasy movie, especially of the time. But even into today where it's like, you know, she's not looking away. She's not scared of it. She's just, let's watch this guy die in a very gruesome manner. And that's,
she's also not Xena warrior princess or anything.
Right.
Like there's exactly. You don't have to go fully Sarah Connor or Ellen Ripley, mm-hmm. you know, on
yeah,
the
I love
can,
that.
There's,
mm-hmm. Yeah, she's willing to look at facts in the face. Mm-hmm. And that's one of her big strengths. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So the following morning, you have the scene where the hawk goes to Philippe instead of Navarre. And it's a good scene. You know, wait, you change clothes together? No, not together. What? You left her alone?
And he never even tells Navarre, oh, yeah, we danced together. Philippe can tell, this is a story I'm going to de-emphasize. Right. He does not need to know that Isabeau and I had a happy little dance before we ran into the murdering.
Yeah, I mean, he already says, right, every moment you spend with her, I envy you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then he says, you'll tell me everything she said. And then he goes on one of these flowery kind of maybe embellished things, but I'm not mm-hmm. certain. We don't see the scene, mm-hmm. but in the way he's retelling it, it's after all of the events with Cesar.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
So I kind of believe that this is what actually took place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he's in love with her by this time. Philippe is in love with her.
Oh,
so I felt like the dance was like his, he could just keep that himself. I can just keep that memory. It doesn't need to have any, it doesn't need to have anything transposed on top of it because I remember what happened when I told Navarre about it. Yeah.
Right. And for those who don't know, I have done medieval dancing in a troupe, and so some, you know, they're not dancing like tango or something like that. They're dancing a period, you know, he bows, he extends his hand, you know, they go in a cross arm movement and then they do a hand circle dance, you know, it's very period. It's mm-hmm. not like they were bumming and grinding.
It's not dirty dancing.
Not dirty dancing.
Yeah.
You know, it was a sweet moment of happiness. They were having a little bit of happiness together as friends. Mm-hmm. And yes, maybe he had dreams in the back of his mind, mm-hmm. but you know, he was no fool. he knew she wasn't for him.
And I think even then his dream would have been, if we can't end this curse, maybe I will just travel with them for the rest of my life or their lives. And I will continue to have these memories with this woman in the evenings, you know, mm-hmm. but she's in love with the wolf.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So then we get to the frozen river crossing that goes very, very badly. When the wolf falls through the ice.
It's terrifying.
It is terrifying. And coming from a wintry place, growing up in a wintry place, I remember the dread of hearing ice crack under you when walking on a lake.
You could die.
And, you know, all of us were, you know, trained about, okay, get low, you know, mm-hmm. spread
lay
your weight out.
Spread out. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's Imperius is a scientist and mm-hmm. he tells him to, you know, lie down. The broken ice doesn't look very realistic, but mm-hmm. the wolf's distress is very realistic. And mm-hmm. And like you said, JW, they used actual wolves, and that wolf actor really earned his pay. So.
Yeah, and the terrible scarring,
scratches.
You know, that which would happen anytime you're trying to rescue a wild animal, you risk getting injured.
rescuing a person, you risk, you know, both of you drowning, right?
Right. For those who haven't seen it, Mouse tries to rescue the wolf, and the wolf, in its panic, scratches at him.
And he does rescue him, but...
Right.
Yeah.
But he gets very scratched up on his chest.
And, you know, this leads to always my favorite scene of the movie, where the next morning the sun hits upon them and they see each other for a brief moment. And it's just heartbreaking.
So that was interesting to me. They're, for some reason, they're drying out kind of in a pit. You know, the next morning you see this is after they've dragged themselves all wet and sopping, probably built a fire and dried out somewhere. Yeah. But anyway, the light, they're in a pit. And if you are in a pit, the way the sun hits is a little bit different. So it hits the wolf, and she can see Navarre in his human form.
Yeah.
For a brief, brief moment, their hands are reaching to each other, and then
The wing.
Then she transforms.
Yeah.
And Philippe is watching this magic.
Yeah.
And crying his eyes out. Awestruck by it, quietly crying, not wanting to interrupt or anything, but he's overwhelmed by this moment. And it's foreshadowing eclipse. For those who are wondering what that, you know,
Day Without a Night
is, who haven't seen other movies where eclipses or read other books where eclipses are happening.
Mm-hmm.
I think, is it A Knight in King Arthur's Court where there's an eclipse that he happens to predict, the guy who goes back in time, and so everyone thinks he's either with God or a devil or a genius or something. Right. So kind of a medieval thing where not everyone knew about eclipses. Those who happened to figure it out or get a message directly from God about it coming up had an edge on everyone else.
Yeah.
This thing in the pit with the way the light hits part of the pit, that's foreshadowing on the eclipse.
Yeah. And I really appreciate the fact that they didn't go for any real morphing in this movie. And I don't have any problem with morphing. I think it's a fun scene in Willow where Willow is trying to transform whatever her name is, back to her form. But here it's very subtle. The only thing you really see is the eyes.
Yeah.
When Navarre first looks up, he still has wolf eyes. And I think that's very cool. And then the first change you see in her is her eyes change to hawk's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very neat. But you know, his anguished cry is just, it's one of the great ones in all of cinema.
Yeah. And the way that he scoops the snow, you know, I could feel it. I could feel the cold when he does that. It's part of the despair of that cry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then Navarre is angry because they've hidden his sword from him because they're trying to trick him into going through with the curse breaking. And this is where it's revealed to him that Philippe saved his life. And I like that moment. I'll show you idiots how to cage a wolf.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a great line in context. You know, he's been very angry with them, and then he realizes whatever was going on last night, I really seriously injured this person who's been a friend to me.
Yeah.
And it sets him back, even while he's still kind of despairing. He's willing to try things, partly because he realizes he's been at fault here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. I think empathy kind of stops him in his tracks and allows him to see their side. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's try this thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I loved that it wasn't Mouse who said, "You did this to me." It was who says, "You injured him while he was saving you." I mean, that was, again, just a very subtle thing. But if it had been Mouse saying, "Well, this was from you," it would have had, I think, less impact because Mouse was so much like he didn't want to champion himself in this moment. It wasn't about him. And it was just a great move for their development.
Yeah, Mouse was kind of covering himself up, like almost ashamed of what had happened. I don't know how to articulate why, but that seemed very in character with him. Mouse is not one who's laying his heart out for everyone to see all the time. He talks with God all the time. Mm-hmm. He'll complain, but even when he says flippant things like he doesn't even know, you know, who his mother is, that's a kind of his own armor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he's not going to be talking about I'm seriously injured here. You know, he didn't want to bring that into the story. He was just going to keep wearing his shirt and not ever show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But he's a kid who's lived without love. You know, he's not had people to love or encourage him or sympathize with him. And so for him to try to get somebody to sympathize with him, it would be against his character.
Right. I mean, I imagine he had learned on the streets that if you show weakness, mm-hmm. people won't give you a hug. Mm-hmm. They'll knock you down and take whatever you have.
Yeah.
Those learned behaviors mm-hmm. of don't open up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was almost thinking of it as a shame thing that he was mm-hmm. covering Navarre's shame on Navarre's behalf.
Right. You know, yeah. He's protecting Navarre.
He didn't take it personally that the wolf had scratched him up. Mm-hmm. He wasn't trying to say, Navarre, you jerk. You know, he knew perfectly well that
it was a wild animal doing what it was supposed to do. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think it all kind of speaks to the fact that his character is growing through this mm-hmm. whole thing. He comes from the very selfish to giving himself for other people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. So then we finally move into the return to Aquila. Right. Mm-hmm. This is the culmination of the movie where Philippe has to go back in through the sewers. Go ahead.
Favorite quote. We've come full circle, God. Philippe says, I would like to believe there's a higher meaning in all this. It would certainly reflect well on you.
Yes, that was the one line that I didn't totally remember. So
it's great.
It's good. And this is where he's finally going to actually break into the cathedral, mm-hmm. where he had tried to do it at the beginning of the movie. And here he's able to do it. Meanwhile, Isabeau and Imperius are coming in through the very menacing looking gate system in Aquila mm-hmm. with the wolf that comes about 2 seconds from being killed by a random guard. How strange that's exactly what the bishop said. I'm sure he would understand you're depriving him of that pleasure. He's a very forgiving sort of man. I did not write this line down, by the way.
Seth more or less what was said, yes.
Yeah. Oh no, it's exactly what's said. Seth has a memory for auditory.
I remember coming out of that movie, and the main thing that I remembered was the little rhyme at the very beginning when Philippe escapes, right? The mouse, he's left our house. No mouse today, he's run away.
Yes.
Right.
I knew that as soon as I, by the time I left the theater, I had that one. Mm-hmm. I love the chant. The Gregorian chant kind of thing that's going on in the cathedral. Mm-hmm. It's just a wonderful, it's a contrast with how evil the bishop is. Right. Mm-hmm, it just sounds very holy to me.
Right. So they're going in to the cathedral to confront the bishop as the prophecy that Imperius got, said they needed to do to confront him. And in the movie, what's going on is this is the time when the clergy all go into the church for the clergy confession.
Yes,
that's what I understood. And so they're locking the doors of the cathedral, so no one, the hoi polloi, will not be hearing the confessions of the priest.
Right,
only the bishop. And kind of each other, in a way, kind of a binding if they're all going to be hearing these confessions. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, but that's what's going on. That's why there will be fewer people in the church. No little children this time to look at Mouse and say, hey, mommy, look at, so it should be it's a coincidence that our heroes don't really know exactly why this is the right time to go. They just know this is the right time to go.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's going to be a time where Imperius knows the bishop is going to be there hearing the confession mm-hmm. and that there's going to be this astronomical event mm-hmm. occurring as well. Mm-hmm. But Philippe has to get in there and unlock the door so that Navarre can come in.
Right.
And there's that other heartbreaking moment where Navarre is saying, look, nothing's happening. Nothing's changed. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go in there and kill the bishop. If the service ends peacefully, I beg you, take Isabeau's life.
Yes.
instead of damning her to a half-life. And it's a heartbreaking moment, mm-hmm. so wonderfully portrayed by Rutger Hauer. I think he's an underrated actor. Yeah, like really put in good performances all the time.
Mm-hmm. However, Trish and I were a little indignant. He didn't talk to Isabeau about this. And Imperius were deciding, the men were deciding, this right. life is too hard for the woman. She won't be happy all on her own, so we'll kill her. Yeah. This was not something that I actually liked about the movie, sure. but I accept that it's in character for despairing Navarre
yeah.
to tell, you know, Imperius, and for Imperius to think, well, if my prophecy's not true, then it's all terrible. But anyway, mm-hmm. yeah, we were frowning mightily yeah. on the couch watching this part.
I turned to my wife and said, I mean, maybe give it a few hours.
Give it a little time. Well, and too, this is the, for 16-year-old me, this was that Romeo and Juliet, the ultimate yes. of romance, mm-hmm. that one cannot live without the other. So to me, that was all that meant. I didn't even go into the, you know, oh, well, she should have had some choice. No, this is ultimate romance. And they would kill her while she was a bird, of course. They were not going to kill a woman, you know.
Right.
So, but yes.
Yeah, I guess I didn't really sense that dynamic. But now that you mentioned it, Sarah, I can definitely see it. I kind of went with like the same thing of it being the ultimate romance and also it being almost like a chivalry thing based on the setting that like, you know, this is the end one way or another for all of us, essentially. Like, mm-hmm. Please make it the end. I don't know. Maybe I'm wording that wrong, but
yeah,
I can see the power of the scene and also some of the problematic nature of it, I guess.
It was certainly watching it the first time, I'm sure I was just swept along by the yeah. whole thing. It's you know, now, you know, I'm in my 50s.
I see what you're saying.
I'm kind of side-eyeing this moment.
Yeah, I get it.
And so, our world is different now than it was then.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, yeah. So Navarre presents himself to the other guards, right, and says, look, I ask you to let me pass. And the guy says, look, I have my orders. And he just, you know, smacks his sword out of his hand and is like, yeah, no, you're gonna let me pass. And the guy's like, yep, yeah, we're cool. So, and it's a great entrance where Philippe is about to get killed by someone in the cathedral, which I got to think, you know, maybe the bishop would say, don't kill people. Maybe just grab them and take them outside the church. Mm-hmm. Although it is the bishop, so who knows? But it's a wonderful yeah. entrance with the horse coming in and cantering, you know? It's
awesome. Well, and the horse kicking the door.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and I do remember thinking, what are armed guards doing inside the cathedral? Like, I've never right. been to a cathedral where there were armed guards. It is medieval times, but still.
Yeah. I don't know. You've never been to church in Texas?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've been to church in Alaska many times and
right.
the entire audience is packing, but they're all yeah. concealed carry.
Right.
I just assumed, difficult.
I think of them as the bishop's guard.
Yes.
Yes, that's true.
He doesn't trust everyone.
And he doesn't trust anyone.
Right. Yeah. But these are the men he pays.
Yeah, and so, I think yeah, you're
my,
right.
my guards come with me wherever I go.
Yes.
That's kind of how I figured it. So.
That's true.
Although, yes, the whole thing of, you know, fighting in the church, yeah, blood yeah. in the church, that's not good.
Yes. And yet, I guess when you go, like when my family went to Canterbury Cathedral several years ago, you see the three-pronged sword on the wall where Thomas Kempis was killed right there at the altar.
Yeah.
So in medieval days, that kind of thing probably did happen. I mean, it did.
Thomas More, probably.
Thomas More. Beckett?
Was it Thomas?
Thomas
A. Beckett?
Yeah, Thomas Beckett.
I think it's Thomas A. Beckett. Yeah, right.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. One of those
So many Thomases.
So many Thomases.
Yes. Yes. It was Beckett. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
and,
so.
You know, a cathedral
Well, no one
is,
rid me of this priest.
Yes,
that one.
Exactly.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And someone did.
Yes. Oh, I was just kidding, but...
Yes, right, yes. Right. And here I am doing my concealed carry of my sword. I happen to have what you need.
Yes.
Deniability.
Yeah. The cathedral is a wonderful venue for the fight, though, because it's...
Oh, all that glorious and, yeah. light.
And the
stone,
echo.
The sound
yes.
of it. Yeah.
Yes.
And
yes.
so, you know, Marquet shows up. They have their... I think it's a great sword fight.
Yes.
You know, where they're on their horses for a while. And then, mm-hmm. you know, basically as soon as you unhorse the other guy, you have mm-hmm. a major advantage. And, yeah. and I Is that the part where Marquet throws his helmet up through the window pane?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. He throws it at.
Which is important.
Yeah, it's important.
Yeah, I think he's trying to throw it at.
At Navarre.
At Navarre.
Yeah.
But he misses and it goes through the skylight at the top.
Yes.
Which allows direct
evidence
sight of the sun.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And broadsword fighting is so different than rapier, you know, épée fighting. It's our boys fenced for a while, but our daughter is really into like Renaissance fair and broadswords. And so she appreciated the fact that broadswords, sometimes the guys do come shoulder to shoulder and have to bump each other away from each other because that broadsword isn't a close combat weapon. And they do some of that, you know, wrestling kind of and then coming back apart.
Yeah. I mean, it's still Hollywood sword fighting, right? They're not doing a lot of the actual medieval martial arts that you would see. The big swings and that kind of stuff are, they leave you very vulnerable.
Very.
Not really the
horse
way
accurate.
Yes.
Swordplay, perhaps not accurate.
Sure. So. Yes. Never turn your back.
It's still wonderful. And this was the thing that I had to correct on the Wikipedia article because it said that Navarre killed Marquet with his father's sword. And that is not Navarre was unarmed at that point. Mm-hmm. And there's that wonderful move where he rolls back toward Marquet as he's trying to stab him and then rolls over the sword and impales him on his own sword. Mm-hmm. And it's something I've seen in other places. I remember there was a Teen Titans comic with Deathstroke the Terminator where he did a move like that. But I remember thinking it was an incredibly cool moment. And it looks really good. The stabbing, like it looks very realistic. It's well portrayed by both the actors. Ken Hutchinson, who played Marquet, not in a ton of other things, but good physical presence, good fight there. Mm-hmm. Enjoy that. Any other comments on the sword fight? So this brings up now the confrontation with the bishop, where before the end of the sword fight, the bells ring. Right, he tries to stop the bell ringer at some point because he realizes as soon as the bells ring, Imperius is going to kill Isabeau instead of waiting a few hours. and so then he's just, okay, this is it. You know, I don't
All
even need to survive.
Lost.
Yeah. Yeah. I just need to kill the bishop. If I can kill the bishop, everything's good. Mm-hmm.
So he's actually seen the sun and the dark splotch on the sun already. Right. Right? So he starts having hope that, maybe I don't have to kill the bishop after all.
Right.
And then
Marquet
during the fight,
him. Yeah.
Right. Then during the fighting, the bell gets rung and he's, you know, and he actually realizes it partway through the fight.
Yeah.
The bells are ringing. Isabeau is going to die. I have to, you know, how can I, you know, so that's going through his mind while he's fighting. Mm-hmm. But he's seen it. He's seen what we think of as an eclipse. You know, and realizes this is how the miracle could work, you know, and
if I had not spoken first and said to kill her, it could have worked.
Right.
Yeah. So now his job is to make sure that the bishop knows she's dead because that is the cruelest thing he can do to him and then kill him.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And the bishop isn't even really trying to defend himself. You know, he thinks he has a trump card, like, the curse will go on forever if you kill me. Mm-hmm. And then when Navarre says Isabeau is dead, even though if you're paying attention, if you watched it many times, you can see Isabeau come into the background. Mm-hmm. And I noticed it last night. I'm not sure I had noticed it before that you can see her back there. Mm-hmm. She waits maybe a little too long to intervene. but it's a great scene when he first sees her and he's not sure that she's real.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course the bishop, you know, John Woods doesn't have a lot of lines of dialogue in the movie, but the things that he does with his face are really, really good.
Yes. And the body language, that shivering back as if evil is coming toward him. And yet it actually is evil being released. But
yes, it's really interesting. It's like he's afraid of Isabeau.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And whether that's something that was kind of always true or if it's because of the magic, you know, I don't know. It's interesting to look at that. One reason I like to rewatch this movie is there's, you know, subtext here and it's shifting and you can read it multiple ways and it makes the rewatch, you know, much more interesting when not everything is spelled out.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And so then you have the moment, right? Look at her, look at me, look at us, right? Mm-hmm. Look at us. I really like that. And the bishop is so good. I mean, John Woods is so good. Just he's shattered. You can see mm-hmm. he's completely shattered.
Yeah.
And the sound of the leather against the metal of his sword, because he's twisting his sword, and the sound of that leather of his outfit. Yeah. I can mm-hmm. still hear that creak of that as he's, you know, adjusting it.
Another great score moment is when Isabel finally comes up to Navarre and he's just kneeling there and she's walking very, very slowly. And finally he just reaches out and grabs her because he's not sure it's real. Right. Yeah. And so when they finally touch and he notices that she's holding the blinders and the jesses.
Right.
And then all of a sudden her eye goes from her to the bishop. And there's a great moment in the score.
I'm not done with you yet.
Yeah. And then she just goes over and then looks at him with just the ultimate disdain. Mm-hmm. She's a little more made up than I expected.
Magic.
Yeah. She just magically, turned back into a woman in front of Imperius, and Imperius had a nice compact for her to put her face on.
Yes. She had to be properly attired to see the bishop.
Right. And it might be one of those things that my wife pointed that out. She's like, she's wearing a little more lipstick than I expected. But I'm like, it could be just the HD video. I've noticed that on some things that were originally meant to be seen in standard definition, that when you see them in high definition, you see everybody's makeup.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when you see a black and white movie that's been colorized and you're like, oh, that's really alarming. And it's like, it's because they picked these textures and things that stood out. And I've said that a couple times with the Blu-ray, it is such high def. Like, am I seeing it? Things that I'm noticing that they wouldn't have noticed, when you guys saw it in theaters,
I don't know. You are noticing things like we would not have seen.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So she drops the leather jests and everything at the bishop's feet, her hawk gear. She kind of flings it at his feet. She turns, she and Navarre are ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're done with him. Yeah. I don't think they're going to kill him. They're just going to walk out their own free selves and be done with all this stuff and go live their life.
Yeah. Yep. But the bishop has one last plan.
But he cannot let them.
Yes. Mm-hmm. No man shall.
Yes.
And then you have the wonderful sword throw that was introduced earlier in the movie into a tree, but this time into a bishop. Aaron, did you ever read the novelization?
I did, but it's been so long, and I don't have your memory.
You said you read it as well. I read it
several times, but not in the last 10 years for sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I seem to remember that the bishop turned into a wolf at the end.
That's what I remember too. Yes. Yeah. And I keep thinking, did I see that in the movie or was it in the book?
Yeah. Definitely not in the movie, but it may have been in an earlier shooting script, that they made a different decision. Mm-hmm. That's basically the end of the movie, and then you have them, enjoying seeing each other again and being able to touch each other. Meanwhile, Philippe and Imperius try and let's leave him alone.
Well, and there's that wonderful scene when he picks her up in his arms and he says, Isabeau, but he picks her up and up and up and up, and then she puts her arms out like a bird and he flaps her. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's lovely. Yes. And then
I love you.
Oh, yes, that's right.
She says, I love you, Navarre, to everyone there.
Yes.
Which before, when they were recording in secret.
Yes.
Right.
Before all the magic stuff, because she was Isabeau of Anjou and he was just a captain. But done with all that. And tells it to the world that, they're not keeping this hidden anymore.
Yes,
then I do like the Imperius and Mouse,
wrapped in each other's arms.
Yeah. They're so happy.
They're so happy for
their friends. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yep. And I love the, I fully expect to meet you at the pearly gates, young mouse. Don't you dare disappoint me. I'll be there, father, even if I have to pick the lock.
Yes, great.
Yeah, it's a great way to exit them. And of course, you know, all the priests and clergy and everyone are all rejoicing with the couple, even though the bishop is lying there dead and Marquet is there
right.
dead.
Right. So that's what I was going to say. The clergy are kind of waving their hands excitedly and praisingly and happy yeah. that their bishop is dead. So yeah. I am thinking maybe there was the reason for the bishop to keep his guards with him at all times.
Yeah.
Because maybe some of the clergy had picked up that there's something bad here.
Yeah. yeah. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, they're rounding up the rest of the bishop's guard and putting
disposing
them on trial
of them
for
quietly.
War crimes. Yes.
Well,
rounding
mean,
up the collaborators.
And there were so many points where the bishop made it very clear that he was just going to have anybody who did anything that displeased him in any way just killed.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I was kind of thinking that at the end of the movie when I was watching it last night, are the, because I thought it was sort of strange, right, that all the priests come in and are celebrating too. I was like, are they happy for them or are they just happy that the reign of terror, you know,
right.
is
ding over? Dong, the wicked witch is dead.
Sure.
Yes.
Sure.
Yes.
And, but again, it's sort of going back to what we mentioned like way earlier, just the faith contrast here playing out of, it's almost like they're recognizing like the true, you know, belief that the true way things are supposed to be is found with, you know, these two and not with the bishop. And we're just going to let him like yeah. hang off the sword over in the corner for a little while. And
yeah. Yeah. He was supposed to just put a jewel in the sword. Instead, he put the sword in the bishop.
Right. Yeah, I was just thinking about that. He never does get that jewel, does he?
Yeah.
No.
And he leaves his heritage sword behind, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does
well, I, it doesn't show them. Out of, yeah, it yeah. doesn't show them leave. It just fades to black. And
yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. All right. Yeah. But he didn't like immediately pull his, you know, father's sword out of the box.
Wipe it off. Yeah. No.
Right. No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No.
It is important to care for your swords once they've been blooded. So.
It is. Yes. Never put away your sword dirty.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Chronicles of Narnia.
Yes.
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 That's what I was
That's
thinking.
That's right. That's best practice.
Yep. Yes. Yeah. So anyhow, it's a wonderful movie. You know, final thoughts. Anybody jump in?
I guess I'll jump in and since I started off. Again, so just having watched it with no context the first time, I do very highly recommend watching it. Even, you know, after listening to this, I think that pretty much anyone who's a fan of fantasy in any way would find something to love about the movie.
Yeah.
And the fantasy elements are relatively subtle enough that even if you aren't a big fan of fantasy, I think you'd find plenty to enjoy. I've mentioned a few times The Princess Bride as my sort of foil for this movie.
Yes.
The Princess Bride is much funnier.
Yes.
That's the point of The Princess Bride in some ways, you know, true love, revenge, you know, all the above. But if you like The Princess Bride, this is how I always sell it to people. You're going to like this movie. Like, I would be shocked if you didn't.
Yeah.
So I just really highly recommend it. It's super fun. The music is all over the map, you know, and really enjoyable and endearing in its own way. And the performances are great. So just give it a try, you know. And we also need, I want to add an addendum. Anyone who is tech savvy, please make GIFs of this movie for
yeah,
Twitter.
Right?
Because
yeah.
there are so few I can find, and I have no idea how to do it, and I'm not about to start learning because I don't have time. So
we should hit up the Continuum Drag guys. They make all kinds of gift gifs.
Oh, they do. Yeah. They do.
Okay.
We
yeah,
have to
like,
get them to watch the movie first. But
because this movie is so memeable, it's so gifable, like it would make so many great ones. And there's only like two or three of just the bishop, I think, that I was able to find.
Mm-hmm.
So please
yeah.
help me out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm distracted because I like that idea so much
mm-hmm,
of having
mm-hmm.
clips, you know, little
yeah.
gifs and stuff mm-hmm. from it.
Yeah, I can reach out to
good
Luke.
Good idea. well, they do neglected TV series. This
yes.
is of science fiction and fantasy. This is a neglected movie of,
yeah.
you know, so mm-hmm. there's a line there to try and sell it to them.
Yeah. Maybe I'll try and figure out how to do it now that I have it on physical media. I guess I have an old DVD on the shelf behind me, actually. But yeah.
Right. Yeah. I was really glad to watch it again. It was even better than I had expected it to
yeah.
be. I expected it to be fun. And I found it was more rich than I had realized. It leaves me wanting. I mean, I think it ended well, but I kind of want more.
Mm-hmm.
I want, you know, maybe
an
I'm going to go look and Yeah, an epilogue or fanfic with Mouse with some other characters, right. His further adventures. How does he grow? Does he stay a thief? You know, right. Or does he not because of the character growth that he's had?
He becomes an innkeeper, you know, like a barkeep who has great stories for people.
Yeah. I can see that.
Right. Imperius becomes the bishop.
He could definitely be a great barkeeper. Barkeep. Bartender. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, so Seth just told me about this late last night. Hey, would you like to join us? So I didn't get a chance to preview the movie again for the, you know, I don't know, 100th time. But I will definitely watch it today because this has like made me want to go through it again. Yeah. And I just think that it's one of those movies that you start out with the 80s synthesized music. You got to get past that. Because by the end of the movie, you are so enthralled, you know, you will watch it again.
Yeah. Yep. Cool. All right. Well, thank you all for doing this. I had like six people, on the docket for this and it had fallen off to, I just had two. And so that's when I reached out to you, Aaron. I thought, well, okay, I bet I could get somebody else to do this. And so I was right.
Yes.
So thank you so much for doing it. So, JW, where can people find you?
So I can be found on Twitter at JWWARTICK. And also on my website, eclectictheist.wordpress.com. And I just love talking about sci-fi fantasy all the time, but also history, philosophy, theology. So hit me up. I'm interested in most things.
Nice. Sounds good. All right, Sarah.
So, on Twitter, I'm at Configures. So Sarah Elkins and Configures. I do DevOps. I also tweet about a fair bit of science fiction. And I tweeted up a storm during WorldCon, for instance, as I was watching virtual events. But also talk about tech things some and some politics and allyship type tweets there. That's mostly where I am online. I'm on Facebook, but that's pretty locked down, etc.
Nice.
And Aaron, I did want to say I was really glad you could join us too. I knew JW and Seth were going to be on it, but it was really good getting your perspective too. Fun with people who watched it back then and the new viewer, JW. So this was a really fun discussion. Thanks to everybody.
Yeah. It was very fun. Very fun. So, yeah.
And I know you're not on Twitter. So,
yeah, I'm only on Facebook. That's fine. You can reach me through Seth.
Yeah, there we go. And if you want to hear more from Aaron, we did a Comfort Reads episode on the Chronicles of Narnia.
Yes.
Sarah and I did a Comfort Reads episode on Connie Willis's Bellwether. And we're going to do an episode in the future of the main Hugo show. And then JW and Sarah has been on a number of the Hugo nominees panels as well with me. And then JW has been on those and we did Dream Snake for the main show, which was awesome.
That's a fantastic book.
Yeah. Someday we'll
I talked
do.
About Dream Snake on another podcast, which I tweeted about. So, that's a fun book and a good discussion.
Yeah.
Y'all's discussion was good. I listened to like two discussions of Dream Snake and then it ended up I was on another discussion about it too.
Nice.
So another good book.
Yeah. And like I mentioned, you know, this all kind of started from when I was on that episode of Spectology and I recommended this as an underrated movie. So I might follow up with Matt and Adrian and see if we can do a one-off where I think Matt needed to watch Sunshine and Adrian needed to watch Lady Hawk. I can't remember if there was one that I needed to watch too, but maybe I'll get them together and we'll do one of those where we follow up on some of those recommendations. I think we each picked three. So maybe we just talked about the ones we hadn't all seen. Might do that. I might follow up with Jo Graham as well, cause she had wanted to be here, but couldn't do it today. And I wanted to work around JW's schedule because I feel like the whole thing had started from, I think you had put out a tweet about it, about the lack of I always say GIF just so I can offend at least half the people. I've always been a GIF person, so.
Oh.
But not the peanut butter, Adams all the way. But
I was just going to say, I can't even say Jif because the peanut butter is so awful.
Yeah. Ooh, it's vaguely tastes like peanuts. Yeah. Anyhow, that's a different topic. But yeah, so to anybody watching or listening, I'll put links in the show notes or on the video description, and let us know. You know, have you seen this movie? What do you think? I will not accept any negatives. So just I will unfollow you if you didn't like the movie. No,
delete the comment.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So no, all opinions are welcome, especially if they agree with us. So. All right. Don't anybody hang up. I'm just going to say goodbye for the video.